This is the Best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, brought to you by Coach Pete at Capital Financial Advisory Group. Visit us at capitalfinancialusa.com. This is the Adam Gold Show.
Thank you very much for spending some time with us on a Tuesday. It's a heck of a performance last night.
Yeah.
By the Boston Celtics defense. We'll talk about why it didn't get him anything. Really was. I mean, fascinating, fascinating game last night. I lost all my bets. You won at least one. You're on a heater.
I am on a heater. I think I've been positive at least seven
nowadays,
out of last
eight. Don't want to be positive.
Oh.
Right? We want to be negative. Negative is positive.
What?
Right.
Are we talking golf right now?
No. We're not talking about red numbers.
Oh.
So, anyway, you did well. You had Israel and Iceland to draw.
I nailed that.
Did. 2-2.
I couldn't name one player on either team.
Men's national team plays tonight.
They do.
CONCACAF Nations League. We've been wagering on UEFA Nations League for the last 2.5 weeks. But we'll have CONCACAF Nations League, the United States playing their second match, this one in El Salvador. They beat Grenada 4-0 the other day.
Did it end up being five?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, one guy had four goals.
Okay. Jesus Ferrer had four?
Yes.
I know last I checked he had three. They added one later. In added time. I don't know. Anyway, it's late. It's like a 10 o'clock start. Why are we doing this? I mean, I guess El Salvador is in Central Time?
Maybe.
It must be in Central Time. Don't know. Apparently, there'd be no reason to start it at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. So that'll be tonight. We have a ton of things to talk about, including Game 5. You can watch us on TV. Hi. Channel 34.1. Yeah, Dennis, wave to the camera. You got to talk, otherwise you can't. Nobody will see you.
That's fine.
Okay. 34.1. On your antenna, if you're local to the WREL TV5 viewing area, channel 1257 on Spectrum Cable, same deal. Fire, Roku, Android, Apple TV, WREL Sports Plus app. All right, let's go. For the first time in, I think it's 131 playoff games, whatever the number is.
132.
Steph Curry failed to hit a three-pointer. Chef cooked up an 0-for-9 in a 16-point effort, a little more than half of his playoff average, and it didn't matter. Mm. Warriors take Game 5, 104-94. Boston's strategy, and you could tell early, eliminate Curry. There was no help off of Curry. If somebody got beat and the closest player was Curry, that player, that defender did not help. You stayed with Steph Curry for the entirety. And they switched off. They used a lot of different players on Steph Curry. Sometimes it was Smart, sometimes it was Tatum, sometimes it was Brown, sometimes it was Al Horford, sometimes it was Derek White, but somebody always was on his hip the entire game. And it worked. Sorta. Except for Andrew Wiggins was not cooperating with Boston. 26 points, career playoff high. 13 rebounds, second highest total in that regard in his career after last game's 16 rebound effort. And here's Wiggins.
You know, something I've dreamt about for sure, you know, being in the league. And, you know, this is ultimate stage. Doesn't get bigger than this. So I was out there just being aggressive and, you know, it was a good game.
Yes, it was a good game. He was awesome in the game. There's a lot of players that played really well for Golden State. Mm-hmm. Klay Thompson, again, third game in a row. Like I said this before, because I remember when Boston lost Game 3, the prevailing thought was they wasted the Klay Thompson game. Because he was great in Game 3 at 25 points. He was very efficient. But they don't need Klay Thompson to be great. They just need Klay Thompson to be good. And Klay Thompson was good, not great, in Game 4. He was closer to great in Game 5, but really, he was just effective. And he's an elite shooter.
Yeah, 5 of 11 five, from behind the arc.
Exactly. 5 of 11 from deep. He had 21 points. And that was really... They don't need Klay to go for 30. They just need Klay to be dangerous. And he was dangerous. Jordan Poole, who only had, I think, 14 points in the game. Maybe he had 15. But an enormous end to the third. Mm-hmm. You heard the banked-in shot from nearly 40 feet. But he also made a three-pointer earlier. And then he had 5 points early in the fourth. So he had 11 points in about a five-minute stretch of play, which restored Golden State to the lead at the end of the third quarter and then helped extend it along with Wiggins and Thompson and even I think Kevin Looney had a tip shot in there as well. It was weird. It was he and Gary Payton II both going for an offensive rebound and it just kind of popped up in the air and went through. I guess they gave the bucket to Looney. Anyway, Poole was really, really big for Golden State in that stretch. And I thought Gary Payton was great on both ends of the court. And I thought Draymond Green was quietly effective on both ends. He was good rebounding. He was good distributing the ball. And he scored some points early on. He got some, he only had 8, but Draymond Green ain't here to score.
Yeah.
Right? And he missed.
All those 8 came early, though. Yeah, all first half.
They did, and he missed basically all of his open jump shots. He made one sort of weird runner in the lane, but I thought Draymond was just an effective player. Again, distributing the ball. He had, I think, 8 points, 8 rebounds, and 6 assists or something like that. It was a triple single.
Yeah, 8, 8, and 6. Yep.
8, 8, and 6. Triple single for
and fouled out.
For Draymond. And he fouled out. Perfect. It's the Gordie Howe hat trick for Draymond Green. And he recognized as much as anything that Steph had been carrying them and everybody kind of picked up for him.
A win is a win, whether Steph gets 43-10-4 or whether he finishes with 16-on-7-for-22 shooting. A win is a win. And, you know, obviously we have spoke about helping him, and I don't think he's been out there helpless. Like, that's the narrative. But everybody's doing their part. And, you know, tonight, a night that he didn't have it going, we found offense elsewhere. And that's kind of what it's been. But in the same token, if he's got it going, we're going to be heavy Steph Curry. That's just what it is. So the whole notion of this guy doesn't, you know, he doesn't have help. Well, he got 43. He's going to keep shooting. And we're going to keep doing all that we can to get him shooting. So it was huge. And, you know, now – that's good for us. You know, he was 0 for 9 from 3. He's going to be livid going into Game 6, and that's exactly what we need.
Look, credit to Boston's defense. Mm-hmm. It was designed not only to take Curry out of his game, but also to get Curry frustrated, which happened.
Yeah.
Because I think I think Curry calmed down later in the game, but Curry's decision-making through the second and third quarters was not good. Like, he got so anxious to make, you know, to pull up and hit a three that all of a sudden, out of nowhere, and they were up by like 12 or 14 points, and he pulls up from the logo, and normally that's not that big a deal because the logos are generally pretty big, and that's within range. But in San Francisco, the logo's tiny.
Mm-hmm.
It's like almost 40 feet, and Steph's jacking up a shot in transition. I'm like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And he did like 3 of those. And he just made some questionable decisions. And I think Boston did get Curry, you know, out of his rhythm and all of that. And they forced him into to bad, you know, some mistakes. But boy, did they get great performances from so many other players. It's still the Steph Curry show. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why Wiggins could go for 22 and 13 and Poole was open. Like, there's, and it's because they concentrated so much on shutting down Curry that it afforded the other players opportunity.
Well, something that stood out to me in the game was, yes, Golden State was 9 of 40 from behind the arc, but inside in two-point range, 32 of 48.
Yeah.
That's over 66%. Mm-hmm. So they were effective inside the arc. Yeah, you took away the three and Steph was 0 for 9, but inside the arc, they were beyond effective.
So 0 for 9, but what was he overall? You know, take the 9 field goal attempts from three-point range. And it's
7 of 13.
Right. So Steph was really good, you know, in drives to the bucket,
yeah,
as was Wiggins, as was Draymond. I mean, they were just really good around the goal.
Take away Wiggins, who was 0 for 6 on 3. He's 12 of 17 inside the arc.
Wiggins didn't make a 3?
He was 0 for 6.
I thought he had made a couple. No, that's right. He made some pull-ups. He made some turnaround pull-ups inside the three-point line. Yeah, look, you figure out how to do it, man. Anybody that's ever played, like, for instance, you're not a golfer, right?
Rarely.
Okay. So, I mean, I still haven't played this year.
Neither have I.
I mean, it's only June. It's in the middle of freaking June. I haven't played golf yet. But anyway, for anybody that's ever played, you know, we're not that good. We don't go out and we don't have the same game all the time. Hmm. We just sort of have to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, all right, dude, can I do this today halfway decent? And the answer is probably no. But at least as best as I can. It changes all the time. You know, these guys have to figure it out too. And Golden State had to figure out a way, a path forward, without Curry scoring a lot of points and without Curry making, or I guess, and Wiggins making threes. And they kind of found their way through with Jordan Poole and Klay Thompson from beyond the arc. But also, again, I keep bringing this up. Gary Payton II, defensively, different dude, just different. That's the way Golden State won the game, I think. Boston turned it over 18 times.
Yeah, 15 points, too.
Right? Led to, Payton was great. Led to 22 Warriors points. I think Boston missed their first 12 threes, but then made 8 in a row and 9 of 10 as they took the lead. Celtics won the third quarter for the first time all series, right? They were down 12 at the half and won the quarter 35 to 24, but it didn't matter. I actually think the Jordan Poole shot to end the quarter was big because all of that work and Boston was still trailing. Here's Ime Udoka, Boston's head coach, because they've got to go back to Boston in game 6 and get it done.
Well, feeling the message to the guys is to be confident going home, get your rest, and then let's get ready to bring it back here. So for us, it's really about consistency, and that's the thing we're not having throughout a full game. It's a consistent effort, sustained effort, more so offensively than anything. And so that's the part where we got to have carry over from quarter to, not only game to game, but even quarter to quarter, like we saw in the third, and it doesn't happen in the fourth. So obviously we're all frustrated with tonight a little bit, but even prior, you know, quarters and games. And so our message is to take it one at a time. We've been here before and did it against Milwaukee, and let's bring it back out to the Bay.
They have been there before. There's no doubt, and it actually was reversed. They had to go to Milwaukee for game 6 in that series, and that was one of the most epic duels we have seen in the NBA, certainly in recent years, where Giannis went for 41, I believe, and Jason Tatum had 46.
Yeah.
That was on the road. This Warriors team is just a little bit different. I keep watching and watching and watching, and I'm confident that the Celtics are better equipped to win this series. And they're down 3-2. And it isn't about home court, because Boston took game 1 in San Francisco. This Warriors team, man. Remember what he said about the Lightning? They're like vampires?
Yeah.
This Warriors team, a bunch of vampires, too. Jason Tatum had 27 points, but he had 4 turnovers. Yeah, it was 95 turnovers in 21 postseason games, or 23 postseason games. 95 turnovers. That is an NBA record. Here's Tatum on being still being confident.
I've said it before. You better be confident, right? You know, we ain't got to win 2 in one day. We just got to win 1 game on Thursday. And we've been in this situation before. So You know, it's not over. We just got a win on Thursday, and that's all we got to worry about right now.
They have, they're headed down the road of they'll need to, a third straight game seven. A third straight game seven. Hasn't been done in like 40 years. I think something like that, where a team needed three game sevens to win a title. But that's what it's going to take for the Boston Celtics. All right. According to a report, nice, from our friend Jonathan Jones of CBS Sports, who, by the way, was elevated to, I believe I get this right, senior NFL insider.
Yes.
The Carolina Panthers are still in hot pursuit of current Cleveland's quarterback, Baker Mayfield.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, that's the kind of music we need for this.
Yep.
Because they are yearning, longing for Baker Mayfield. Am I crazy? Dennis, didn't you also think we were out of the woods with this?
Why is this still a thing? How is this still a thing?
I thought that, like, because we heard about all this leading up to the draft.
Yeah.
Right? This was all leading up to the draft. Oh, they go good, Baker Mayfield. But then they landed the prize, the quarterback prize of the entire draft pool when Matt Corral fell into their lap.
Yeah.
I just assumed, all right, the desperation was over. They had swiped right. Do you swipe right or swipe left?
Depends on what you want.
I want
right.
I swiped right. We got Matt Corral. We can swipe left on Baker Mayfield. But nope. They're swiping right on Baker Mayfield. They still want Baker.
Why?
Have to have that conversation.
What more is to discuss about a trade between these two teams that hasn't been talked about already?
Well, here's the snag, according to Jonathan Jones.
Mm-hmm.
The snag is that the Panthers want or need the Browns to pick up a good chunk of the Mayfield salary.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something we've known.
Yeah, right. So, look, I said that it would be a good idea going into the draft if you could also have Cleveland sweeten the trade. And I keep using the same analogy, the Brock Osweiler analogy, which also involved the Cleveland Browns.
Mm-hmm.
Osweiler, after a year in which he almost looked like a competent quarterback with Denver, only to be benched during at the end of the season and in the playoffs for an obviously broken noodle-armed Peyton Manning who could not throw the ball.
Mm-hmm.
But Osweiler could not lead them to a win. So they went back to Manning just to hand off. Of course, that was the Broncos team that beat the Panthers in the Super Bowl. So Osweiler, the following year, signed a 4-year big money contract, at the time anyway, with the Houston Texans. Texans realized, oh gosh, he's terrible.
Yeah.
We can't have him as our quarterback. So the Browns traded for him. They sent Houston a fifth round pick for the remaining, I think it was two, maybe 3 years left on Osweiler's contract. And Houston sweetened the deal by kicking the Browns back a second round draft pick. So just add that up. The Browns got Osweiler and a second rounder for a fifth rounder. Cleveland didn't really want Brock Osweiler. They wanted the draft pick. And it didn't matter to Houston. They just wanted to get rid of Osweiler. So if you're Cleveland, if you're Carolina, do that to the Browns. I thought going into the draft, that would have been a good idea.
Yeah.
You don't have a pick in the first two rounds. Or you have a first round pick. You don't have a second or a third. You need a day two pick, which they ended up trading into to get, to do it before. Tell the Browns, yeah, we'll take Baker, but you're going to give us your second round pick for him. Perfect deal. You can have a seventh. We'll take Baker because you don't want him and he don't want to be there, and give us a second or at least a third because the Browns are picking relatively high. But that isn't how it went down. And now the Panthers are still pining for Baker Mayfield. Real quick. Because there's three quarterbacks now in this conundrum. Mm-hmm. It used to be just Baker versus Darnold.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you feel about it, Dennis. I can see that Baker is an upgrade over Darnold.
Sure.
I think it's negligible, but it's an upgrade. I agree.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, you know, I don't know how you feel about, you know, engines, but it's like an additional 40 horsepower in an engine.
All right.
Yeah, it really ain't that much.
Not really.
It's not gonna, it shouldn't make or break your season. But I get that Mayfield is better. I also think that you can make the argument that Mayfield has had no chance to really succeed with Cleveland based on injuries, right? You know, we had a really good end to, was it year three when they went to the playoffs and they blew out, right? Right. But, you know, year four starts and year four it starts with a great performance on the road at Kansas City in a loss, but still a great performance. Then he gets hurt in week two and he plays through it.
Yeah.
All right. I know it wasn't his throwing shoulder, but a torn labrum on your left side still affects your whole body. So, and the Browns have been the Browns. But I still don't think he's great.
Yeah.
I still don't think he's great. Anyway, I don't get it. But now you've got Matt Corral in the mix. And they like Corral's future. So what do you need Baker for? Just let Darnold take the bullets for Corral.
Yeah.
Let him get out there. And I mean, what are you afraid of? You afraid you're going to win?
Yeah.
I just don't even understand it. I don't understand what the Carolina Panthers are doing, and I may never understand what the Carolina Panthers are doing. All right, the Charlotte Hornets made news yesterday.
The Charlotte Hornets!
Thank you. Very nice. Very nice. So they're in the news. Montrezl Harrell was arrested on felony drug trafficking charges in Kentucky. All right, here's kind of paint the scenario here. The traffic stop. He was following a car ahead of him too closely. What? That's the traffic stop?
Yeah, I guess.
Sounds like DWB to me. Anyway, they did the traffic stop. Officer noticed the smell of marijuana. And so they conducted a search in the car, and they found 3 pounds of vacuum-sealed marijuana in a backpack in the back seat of the car. And that's felony drug trafficking. I think it's a maximum of 5 years.
Hey, 1 to 5.
All right. 3 pounds?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not an expert. 3 pounds sounds a lot more like personal use than drug trafficking. Sounds to me like that was a purchase, not acting as the distributor. Mm-hmm. So sounds to me like he went somewhere, ye old pot shoppy, and bought it. 3 pounds ain't a lot. I mean, he's not a kingpin here, right? I just don't understand. I think I'm more put off by the traffic stop more than anything else.
If my understanding during the traffic stop, when he was asked if he had marijuana on him, he said he did have a small amount in his possession on his person. So he did say he had that, which I think warranted possible to search as well.
Again, when I read the story, the issue for me is the stop. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's ever on the highway gotten up close to the car in front of you that's not driving fast enough in the left lane? Nobody's ever done that? We're just pulling over. Okay, never mind. All right, Jack Del Rio has had a rough week, but I think we might have overlooked the real problem with what he said, and it isn't necessarily about January 6th. Next. Adam Gold here from my man, Coach Pete DeRuiter with the Capital Financial Advisory Group. We are talking retirement. All right, Coach, simple. When do we start tax planning in retirement?
We should start as soon as possible because here's one thing, Adam. Taxes are not going away.
Right.
And so the game here is we know the rules. A lot of people want to ignore the rules or act like they don't are familiar with them, but the IRS knows the rules. And so when we get to retirement, they're going to reach in and start taking some of their money out of your accounts. So the secret here is to put a force field around as much as possible by strategically moving some of our money to Roth IRA or some of the other vehicles that aren't taxed, like special life insurance policies. You can borrow against your money there and never have to pay tax on your money that you build up inside your cash value. So there are a lot of strategies here. The one strategy that does not work is ignoring it. So let's make sure to not ignore it. The next 10 people will do for you your very own tax and retirement plan that'll help you minimize taxation all the way through retirement.
800-661-7383. All you got is call, or you can text Adam to 21000 for Coach Pete DeRuiter. It sounds like Will Smith.
Oh, this is Rakim.
Oh, okay. I apologize for that. Just sounded like Will Smith for a second. I like both. I'm the guy who likes Will Smith.
Nothing wrong, Will Smith.
Is it all right? Can you say Will Smith slaps these days or no? You're not allowed to say that anymore?
Sure.
I'm not sure you're allowed to say that anymore.
See what you did there.
Exactly. Thank you very much. Especially you have to cover after you confuse Rakim and Will Smith. All right. So Jack Del Rio got in hot water by referring to the January 6th attack on our democracy as a dust up. I get it. I get why anybody would have a problem with that. All right. I'm just going to use this word, semantics. Point of view, yes, but semantics. I want to avoid the politics of this issue here. There are some of you out there that don't believe what happened a year and a half ago is that big a deal. Maybe it's a skosh more extreme than tourists visiting our nation's capital for some of you. All water under the bridge. He got fined $100,000 by his head coach for those comments. Digest that for a second. Mm-hmm. The league didn't fine him. His head coach, Ron Rivera, fined him $100,000. I don't know what Jack Del Rio makes as the defensive coordinator of the Commandos, but what is it? Could it possibly be more than $1.5 million? No way. No way it's more than $1.5 million. 15% of your salary? Find him $100,000. Anyway, here's Rivera on finding Del Rio.
The thing that we all have to understand with these rights, these freedoms, come tremendous responsibility. And we have to understand that as well. And so this is about the impact that was made on our football team, the distraction it has become. And it's a very serious question and topic. But at the end of the day, you know, it did impact us. And that's why I did what I did.
All right. Somehow this became a First Amendment issue for people. The Washington Commandos, not the federal government. Mm-hmm. First Amendment protects you against them, not your employer.
Yeah, a little different.
We gotta stop. He is free to say what he says, right? Did Del Rio get arrested?
No.
And he's free to say what he said, and your employer is free to do what they want to do, again, unless you are employed by the federal government. But here's the real issue for me. And I think it's the real issue, maybe not for Rivera, but if he's talking about how it impacted his football team, then without saying it, he might be referring to this. Because I think it's even more important to the players in his locker room. Because the real issue for Del Rio, from my perspective, was how dismissive he was of, because in the larger context of his statement, he was comparing the dust-up to the summer of 2020 and the, for lack of a better term, the Black Lives Matter protests across cities in the United States. That's what he was referring to. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of just, we've made this all about the insurrection, all about what happened in Washington on January 6th, and not about the real crux of his statement, which was comparing the two. And when you have a league that is 70% black and several players within your locker room were impacted, likely took part in these protests of social justice, and the issue matters to them, probably not a great idea for the defensive coordinator to dismiss all of those issues. Why aren't we talking about that? First of all, we did. It wasn't ignored. There was lawlessness, right?
Yeah.
We all agree that there was lawlessness, and there were things that happened that nobody wants to have happen. But equating the motivation for the two, and I'll use Del Rio's term, dust-ups, skirmishes. I mean, to equate those as equal, it's just, I mean, that's disrespectful.
Yeah.
It's just completely disrespectful to those players. So that, to me, was the issue. It's like, we spent way too much time just, it's a dust-up. I'm like, yeah, it wasn't really that. He could have used anything. Look, I listened to the press conferences at the U.S. Open, and these are obviously, they're not identical issues here. But even the people who were critical and wouldn't go and play on the LIV Tour, when talking about the people who chose to do it, they were softening their language because there are relationships there. So while Rory McIlroy or Justin Thomas or John Rahm, really the three most important players on the PGA Tour, not on the PGA Tour, to the PGA Tour, McIlroy, Thomas, and Rahm, those guys, when discussing individual people who chose to do this, they were a lot more measured in how they discussed those people. You know, nobody really said, well, you know, Mickelson's a greedy SOB. You know, it's like, you know, I've total respect for him as a player and blah. Like, they softened the language because you didn't. So, like, I'm not going to get bent out of shape over Del Rio using the term dust up, because I thought the disrespect was really directed in a different way. And that, to me, was the issue, not the fact that he used the term dust up. I mean, we all know it wasn't a dust up.
No.
All right. When we come back, you know the President's Cup is in Charlotte this year?
It is.
You know who won't be in the President's Cup?
Me.
Well, yes, you. You, that's where you and Dustin Johnson have a lot in common. You will not be in the President's Cup. Same with Bryson DeChambeau. Same with Patrick Reed. They will not. Same with the South African golfers that might have qualified. Louis Oosthuizen, maybe Charles Schwartzel, the winningest golfer in the history of the LIV series. None of those guys will play in the President's Cup because it is a PGA Tour event. We'll talk to the executive director of the President's Cup. It's coming to Quail Hollow in Charlotte. Next.
Over the crossbar! And the Hurricanes have won the Stanley Cup!
June 19, 2006, but it all started May 6, 1997 with the announcement that the Hartford Whalers were coming to North Carolina. It's a story of transition, of heartbreak, of figuring it out on the fly. The Canes Corner look at the 25th anniversary of the move. Presented by the Aluminum Company of North Carolina. Listen now. Find Canes 25th Anniversary wherever you get your podcasts.
Adam Sperling is the executive director of the President's Cup, which is coming this September to Quail Hollow Golf Club in Charlotte. It caused, unfortunately, that event, the Wells Fargo, to be kicked up to Avenel Farms in Maryland, because I love when the Wells Fargo is at Quail Hollow. the Green Mile, the last three holes and all of that. We'll have that for the President's Cup. We just don't know who's going to be there. So I want to start with you there, Mr. Sperling. In light of everything that has gone on, not only this week, but over the last, you know, 4 or 5 months, what has been running through your head about who you're even going to have access to?
I think it probably goes back beyond 4 or 5 months and really 3 or 4 years since we got to Charlotte. And, you know, our job hasn't changed. We're preparing to showcase a best-in-class experience for fans. We've got over 500,000 square foot build-out. We'll hit close to 40,000 people on site per day. So we're transforming this property into a really immersive fan experience. The competition inside the ropes, just like every other President's Cup, is going to be compelling, you know, regardless of the 12 men who make the U.S. or the international team. So, you know, our focus is delivering the best President's Cup in history this year at Quail Hollow. And thanks to the support of the collective communities, you know, we're all well on our way.
It does seem that this event is not as beholden to who's on each team, but the fact is that you do have an American team and an international side, and there are going to be stars. Do you almost feel like you're shielded from some of this? I know we spoke with the people up at Wyndham last week, and, you know, they're going to feel a little bit of a pinch, but maybe you're kind of immune to it.
I mean, I think it'd be naive, you know, not to be aware of what's going on. But I also think you look at the growth of the global game of golf, I think some of which, you know, is supported by, you know, the President's Cup beginning in 1994 and the rest of these countries throughout the world having a team competition to participate in is, you know, 24 of the top golfers in the world are going to come together that week in September, and they're going to create really compelling competition. You know, competition that as golfers, I think, you know, we're all more familiar with playing. I couldn't tell you the last time I participated in a 3 or 4 day event. So I think, you know, match play, it's something you do with your friends. It's something you see on an international scale, and it's exciting. Every match, every day, you know, has a point attached to it. So, yeah. You know, the drama that follows is going to ensue, you know, regardless of who's swinging the clubs.
Adam Sperling, executive director of the President's Cup, coming to Charlotte at the end of September. How do you think this differs preparing a site for an event like this as opposed to preparing a site for a regular event?
Great question. You know, you mentioned the Green Mile, you know, during the annual event, and we will reroute. So I think, you know, we have to approach a property, you know, as do others in match play format, just looking at the 18 holes a little bit differently. Not all matches go 18 holes.
Right.
What's the number? I want to say 89% of matches make it through 15 in President's Cup history. But obviously that starts to fall off pretty significantly through 16, 17, 18. So we'll actually reroute the property for the competition, and that our Green Mile will be 13, 14, 15, which, you know, here at Quail, we'll just introduce an incredible stretch of golf.
Yes.
At real pivotal moments of the match. But it's even beyond that. It's how do people move? You know, they'll all show up for the event at the same time rather than spread out for events that have tee times. You'll have 40,000 people on site, and there'll be 5 matches Thursday, Friday. So that's a different type of gallery experience. So how do we build around that? How do we build in other areas of the course so you can really plan your day and you know, set the day up to cater to how you like to consume the event? You know, where does the competition fit in? Where does the socializing, the shopping, the food and beverage, you know, how immersive an experience, you know, can you jam into one day, and how do you want to go about approaching it? So it's a different approach inside and outside the ropes, but it's fun because you've got a history of excellence here, you know, with the events that have come through Charlotte over the years, whether they be PGA Tour events, PGA Championship in 17. So you've got this incredible golf course with a lot of history and a great foundation, but you're going to approach it with a fresh look given the uniqueness of the nature of the competition. And that's something that I think not only the organizers, but partners and spectators alike, you know, will really enjoy.
State of North Carolina loves its golf. That's obvious. The United States Golf Association has sort of created a hub for itself, not only with offices, but essentially Pinehurst has become their East Coast Pebble Beach. We've had a major championship at Quail Hollow. This is coming to Quail Hollow. What is it about the state, especially Charlotte, where you're going to be, that is so attractive to the tour and for these events?
Well, I think, you know, you got to have the properties. If you don't have the right golf course infrastructure, it's not possible. You have to have the right relationships outside of the golf course in the communities. And that extends not only through, you know, your government support and participation, but your corporate communities. And I think, you know, the biggest one, and I definitely focus on North Carolina, but I think you can go even further into South Carolina, is there's a tremendous appetite within the golf community, within the Carolinas, for the product. A lot of golfers, a lot of golf courses, a lot of fans. And, you know, whether it's, you know, Greensboro or mm-hmm. Hilton Head, Pinehurst or Kiowa, you know, there's a lot of events, you know, not just PGA Tour and majors, but Champions Tour, you know, Korn Ferry Tour. So it's an incredible hotbed, and it's easy access, right? I mean, we're not a long, not a far drive from Raleigh, not a far drive from Charleston. So it goes back, you know, decades and decades. It's been built, and, you know, this community shows up. You know, the Carolina community shows up for golf, and that's why we're so happy to be here.
I mean, there's so many events. Champions Tour is going to be in Cary in October. I think they're in Rock Barn in the western part of the state right before that. Korn Ferry Tour has been all over the Carolinas, and the women were just at the at Pine Needles for the United States Golf Association. How does the PGA Tour – I mean, I know how big – this event is for the PGA Tour, but does the tour envision this? Well, how does the tour envision what the President's Cup really is?
Good question. In what way? I mean, from a growing the game standpoint, from a compelling theater, or from an event?
I hate to leave it broad, but really both of those. I had so many things running through my mind at the same time. I just decided to leave it open ended.
That's fine. That's fine. I can work with that. I think we talk about the nature of this event, and you know, we use terms about, you know, these players playing, you know, for their team, you know, for their country, and for the cup. And I really think the President's Cup brings out the best in the game of golf. I mean, you look at moments, 2003 with Jack and Gary Player, icons in the game, you know, agreeing to kind of, you know, halt the tiebreaker battle after Tiger and Ernie went seven holes trying to determine the cup, and just, you know, calling it a tie. I mean, there's this intense will to win. These guys that, you know, are competing against each other week in and week out come together to compete on the same team. And, you know, from Monday through Sunday, they're all singular focus is to lift that cup. And then Sunday's over and they all come together again. You know, so I think it speaks a lot about what's great, you know, with the game of golf, whether that's for recreational players and participants, spectators, or obviously, you know, it transcends even, you know, to the highest level. And golf's probably one of the few sports in the world that you can say that about.
Adam Sperling is the executive director of the President's Cup. I hope you guys sell a ton of golf shirts and hats and other stuff, and I know you will, and I can't wait to see it at Quail Hollow. It's a great venue, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks. We look forward to having you.
This is the Adam Gold Show.
Over the crossbar, and the Hurricanes have won the Stanley Cup!
June 19, 2006, but it all started May 6, 1997 with the announcement that the Hartford Whalers were coming to North Carolina. It's a story of transition, of heartbreak, of figuring it out on the fly. The Canes Corner look at the 25th anniversary of the move. Presented by the Aluminum Company of North Carolina. Listen now. Find Canes 25th Anniversary wherever you get your podcasts.